we are already almost 3 hours into this, so we haven't talked about Hitler.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we kind of have.
We kind of did.
We kind of have. But let me just... do you want to lay out your argument about Hitler, and then I'll respond to it? And
I don't know if I do want to. I mean, I think I actually think that I should stop, because I'm kind of at the limits of... I'm at the point where the probability that I will say something stupid is starting to increase, and I would rather not, because just saying the things that I'm trying to say that aren't stupid is dangerous enough.
Yes, this isn't the topic where you want to make that kind of error.
Yes, yes. Right, so I would say maybe...
Boy, is there a more charged subject?
It's funny that it's charged, because as you point out, we're pretty much all in agreement about it, right? I mean, you know.
I mean, you find someone who's not, and they're instantly ostracized from society.
Right.
I mean, anybody who has an argument about Genghis Khan, I mean, there's a really fascinating take on this by Dan Carlin from Hardcore History, where he's talking about the amount of time that has passed since a horrible atrocity, and that there are people that will argue that Genghis Khan, who killed 10% of the world's population, changed things so badly that it literally lowered the carbon footprint of the human race while he was alive, killed some untold number of millions of people, and was responsible for their deaths. People look to him, and they find all sorts of positive things to attribute to his reign, opening up trade with China, opening up trade routes, all these different things that people have attributed to him, and that someday someone may do the same thing about Adolf Hitler. Right now,
well,
that is impossible.
He certainly made that job very difficult with all of the documentation,
yes,
and especially the films. But let's just say the argument that I want to level, I want to be really careful to do this so that it can't be misinterpreted by anybody.
I'm gonna enjoy watching this.
Are you? Okay. If I'm cornered, will you
we'll
come
bail you out?
No way, man. The knives are going out.
Oh, no. Okay. So my argument from all those years ago in my paper that I did for Bob Trivers that I mentioned at the beginning was that Hitler was a monster, as we all know, but he was a rational monster. That the program that he deployed was not what he said, mind you. What he said was wrong in many places, especially where it gets near Darwinism. It's just all tangled and broken. But what he did was rational from the point of view of increasing the amount of resource that was dedicated to producing members of his population. And so my point is, this is the danger that we are in if we allow ourselves to imagine that genocidal impulses are more or less gone from the world because we've all agreed that they're a bad thing. And the point is that they exist in a latent program. And at a point when you have austerity as a result of usually an opportunity that has run its course and has resulted in the population growing to fill that opportunity, and suddenly there's nowhere to go because the opportunity has all been absorbed, the tendency of people is to figure out what other population is weak. And if that population is across a border, then there's some excuse for war. And if the population is within the border, then it's a genocide. But the point is, that is an ever-present danger for us.
Okay, so, I want to clarify one thing. I mean, because this argument was sort of phrased as we have a disagreement about Hitler. And I would like to point out that I don't actually disagree with anything that you just said. Because if I remain relatively silent, I don't want to be seen. I don't want it to be seen that the fact that I'm disagreeing with you means, or that there is a disagreement means that it's a disagreement about any of that. I think the disagreement was something like, I said that Hitler was even more evil than we thought he was. And you, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're pointing out the danger of assuming that you can put Hitler in he was just a monster box and don't think about it anymore. And I would say I agree absolutely with that. I mean, I've studied Hitler a lot, and there's a bunch of things that you can't say about him. You can't say he was stupid.
Right.
You can't say he was without artistic talent. You can't say that he was a poor organizer. You can't say that he wasn't charismatic. You can't say that he did wonders for Germany's economy in the first part of his reign. And so it's very necessary when you're if you're dealing intelligently with a true monster, that you give the devil his due.
Yeah. So I think the thing that I saw in your video was your argument was that as he was losing, instead of putting the genocide on pause and winning the war, that he ratcheted up the genocide.
Yeah, I don't know if it would really be. I don't think it's necessarily fair to say that it was him that did that, although I think he had a hand in it. It does appear to me that that's what happened.
Right, and my point would simply be, and again, there, I couldn't possibly be less sympathetic with the individual. My point is simply that from an evolutionary point of view, if your objective is coldly to increase the number of genomes that are spelled the same way that yours are on Earth, that A, he did enslave those Jews who were most fit to work in service of the German war machine. Right, that's what those camps are. Not all of the camps were work camps, but you know, Auschwitz, for example, was both a work camp and a death camp, and so there was this tendency to enslave. And
so let me ask you a question about this, because you know, I think you have to make a pretty tenuous biological argument to say that there's evolutionary utility in increasing the number of your kinsmen, but unless they're very close. But here's a slight variation of that. You tell me what you think about this. Is it reasonable to presume that a decent survival strategy is to homogenize your environment with regards to, under some conditions, to homogenize your environment with regards to racial or ethnic differences to decrease the probability that you and yours are going to be killed?
Oh, yeah. Again, no defense of this, yes. But you are right that to the extent that there's another population that's distinct, that population, even if it is small and has little power now, might not be small and have little power later. And so undoubtedly that program is there too.
Okay.
But I would say that the tendency to believe that evolution only functions at the level of kin when you're talking about very close relatives, I believe is an error that is the result of the fact that evolutionists early on wished to operationalize fitness. And it's very hard to operationalize fitness across population level differences. And so they built a definition that is about immediate kin, but there's no logical reason to imagine that peters out at the edge. All I'm arguing is that what Hitler did was go after a population inside his border that was more distantly related to the people who were his constituents, and then he went obviously after Eastern Europe and sought the future of Germany in Russia. And it took 12 million Russians to turn around the German war machine. I mean, those are military deaths. There were vastly more civilian deaths. But the point is, he did not succeed in doing what he set out to do, but he also didn't fail in the sense that he took a bunch of resources that belonged to a population that was more distantly related, and he got rid of those people. And by getting rid of them, increased the amount of resource that was available to Aryans. This has nothing to do. Genes are not interested in figuring out which genes are superior. All of the language about German superiority is nonsense. However, genes are very interested. I mean, they're obviously genes, they don't think, but they act as if they are interested in replacing alternative spellings.
And so part of the reason that you're walking through this, just so that this, the track of this remains self-evident, is to caution people against, to alert people to the fact that the sorts of programs that Hitler both ran and elicited from people are lurking in our, let's say, in our genome, in our set of biological possibilities. And we have to be very awake to that fact on an ongoing basis.
They are lurking in our genomes, which does not mean that we as adults have this as a possibility. Many people will not go along with this. Other people have it lurking to be triggered. And I think, you know, what worries me is that Trump, I think very cynically, utilized this lurking program in order to gain office, that he played upon the fact that certain people were waiting to hear those noises. And what he said about Charlottesville, you know, again, he did not go after the white nationalists the way
people... Did you see the white nationalist response? Did you see
No.
What it was? Yeah, the Daily Storm had, is that what it's called? One of the white nationalist papers had a breakdown of what Trump did, and that essentially at the end they were saying he didn't go after us, he didn't target us, this was very good. He was very clear that it was all sides, and that he never once targeted us, he didn't say anything bad about us. And then they said, God bless Trump at the end of it.
There's a real tricky issue there about truth, you know, because my free speech, the free speech panel that I was a part of was canceled, I had to make comments in the Canadian media about Charlottesville. And so I really had to think about what Trump said, because the fact that there is reprehensible behavior on both sides of the extremes of the distribution is true. However, truth is a tricky thing because you have to take the temporal context into account. You know, because I would say you can imagine that there are white lies and black truths. A black truth is when you use the truth in a way that isn't truthful, just like a white lie is when you use when you lie in a way that isn't harmful. You can use the truth to wound and hurt, and what that really means is that you've misused the truth, and so it's actually a complex form of lie. But what Trump did wrong, this is independent of whether or not he was actually engaging in manipulation or deceit, was he failed to specify the time and the place for the utterance, because what he should have come out and done was said, I unequivocally denounce the white supremacist racism that emerged in Charlottesville.
Yes.
And then he should have shut up. And then 2 weeks later, he could have said, well, when we look at the political landscape as a whole, perhaps commenting on Berkeley, he could have said, it's pretty obvious that there are reprehensible individuals acting out at both ends of the extreme. But the Charlottesville week wasn't the week to make that point. So, and you know, why he did that, well, it could be just ineptness, because it was a very tricky week to exactly get things right.
I don't think so. I think actually we can look at the what he did during the election, and I think we should expect that he would do exactly what he did.
Let's say there's another issue that we can't contend with, and one of those might be, well, imagine that in order for society to progress, you have to allow the individual to compete in a relatively untrammeled space so that they can innovate. And then imagine that one of the consequences of that innovation is that you get these Pareto distributions developing, because the innovator or the one who's second in line to the innovator, whatever, ends up with the bulk of the spoils. So you might say there's a cost to be paid in inequality for innovation. And then you could also say, well, too much inequality destabilizes things, which seems to be quite clear. So there's room for an intelligent conversation about that, right? Because the lefties say, uh-oh, too much inequality. And they need to be listened to, because the evidence is quite clear. If you let the inequality ramp up enough, the whole system destabilizes, because the people at the bottom think, fuck it, we'll just flip the system upside down.
Right.
No one wants that. Like, right-wing conservatives don't want that. So, because you could make a Republican argument and say, don't let the inequality in your neighborhood get out of hand, because the crime rate will skyrocket. And the empirical evidence on that is overwhelmingly strong. Inequality drives crime. Now, you can argue about why, but the fact that it does, is that's not disputable. So we could have an intelligent discussion between the left and the right, and the discussion would go something like this. You need innovation, you pay for innovation with inequality. But you need to bind inequality, because if it's too intense, then things destabilize. It's like, okay, we could agree on that. We've got the parameters set. Now we have to start thinking very carefully through how to do the redistribution issue, and we don't know how to do that. So you might say, well, we have a guaranteed annual income for people, which I think is a horrible solution, by the way, but it addresses the right problem. The problem is that we're hyperproductive, but the spoils go to those at the top. And some of those resources need to be funneled down to the people who have zero, so that they have an opportunity to at least get to the point where they can innovate, and so the whole bloody thing doesn't wobble and fall. And I would say, in some sense, that's what the political discussion is about. But we've skittered off into these radical oversimplifications, which is something like, well, if you have more than another person, you're an oppressor and you're evil, and if you have less, it's because you're virtuous and victimized, and that's just a non-starter.
So you think that there's a real problem with like something like a universal basic income? You think it's a horrible idea?
I think the idea that the solution is a basic income is not a good idea, because I think the problem is deeper than that. I don't think the fundamental problem is that people don't have enough money. I think the fundamental problem is that human beings, in some sense, are beasts of burden, and if they're not given if they're not provided with a place where they can accept social responsibility, social and individual responsibility in an honorable manner, they degenerate and die. That's the opiate crisis in the West right now. Like, men need men who are men, don't need money. They need function. And we've got a problem. One of the problems is, for example, here's an ugly stat. I think I told you this once before. It's illegal to induct anyone into the armed forces if they have an IQ of less than 83. And the reason for that is the armed forces, despite having every reason to draw the contradictory conclusion, has decided that there isn't a single thing that you can be trained to do in the military if you have an IQ of less than 83 that isn't positively counterproductive. That's 10% of the population. And we're producing a culture that's very cognitively complex. Like, what the hell are you going to do if you can't use a computer? Like, if you can use a computer, you're at least in the game. If you can really use one, you're hyper-powerful. If you're not literate enough to use a computer, you're at zero. 10% of the population. The conservatives say, well, there's a job for everyone if they just worked hard enough. It's like, no, and increasingly no. And the liberals say, well, everyone's basically the same, and you can train anyone to do anything. It's like, no. You can't.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the inequality point here, because if you look at this biologically, actually, I think it reveals a lot. Why are we, I mean, we know from careful study that people are motivated by the degree of inequality more than they are the absolute level of well-being that they have. And there's a very good, it's tragic, but a very good evolutionary reason for this, which is if you are working on some piece of land and your neighbor has the adjacent piece of land and they're doing twice as well as you, it's because they know something you don't, right? And so becoming focused on what they're doing that you're not doing is a rational thing to spend your time on, so you can figure out what it is that they know that you don't. In the modern environment, this is a catastrophe, because who are your neighbors? Well, you've got some box sitting on the wall of your living room that has a totally artificial portrait of other people who may be much wealthier than you, and it's broadcasting in as if you're looking in their window, right, in the adjacent house. And so you think, you're being triggered to think that you're doing something wrong that you might fix, when in fact the solution may not be, first of all, the person on the other side of that screen may not be for real,
right.
But even if they are, they're not living in the same environment as you. The technology is interfacing with our brains badly. But so we have the perception of massive inequality. Economically, we do have massive inequality. You're arguing that the solution to this involves some sort of massive redistribution.
Well, a solution. I wouldn't
argue. But,
yeah,
but no. Nonetheless, redistribution is wildly unpopular for various reasons. And so what we've got now is a situation, this is speculative, but what's really happening is that austerity is being used as a threat to keep people who would otherwise rebel against the inequality in line. And my fear about this is that this is exactly the conditions that are going to trigger that tribal population against population mayhem that we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation. That when people have the sense that the burst of growth that they were experiencing is now over, the natural response is to turn on those who are not as powerful and take their stuff. That this is a totally indefensible but nonetheless biological pattern of history. And that if we want to avoid that, we have to stop sending the signals that trigger us to imagine that we've just run to the limit of the opportunity that we had discovered, and it is now time to look and see who can't defend their position.
How are we sending these signals?
Well, by basically failing to provide enough well-being that people's perception of the inequality is reduced to a tolerable level.
Well, that's the argument for universal basic income, right?
It's certainly a strong one, and I, right. You know,
It's also a good argument for equality of opportunity, right? Because people are actually not as resentful about the success of others as you might expect. They're resentful about it if they feel that the game is fixed.
Mm.
But they're also willing to consider the game long term. So lots of people will say, look, like, I'm stuck at not zero, I'm stuck at one. But my kids might make it to four, and that's good enough. And that's been the American dream, right? And that's a really high power antidote to inequality. It's like, well, yeah, there's some inequality. We need it to keep the generative mechanism going, but the game is fair and you can play it too, and there's some reasonable probability that either you or someone you love will be successful. So that, so it has to be a straight game, and that's why ethics is so important to keep this landscape stable. People can't play crooked games, and the rich shouldn't be fixing the game if they want to hold on to their money. And the problem is that some of them, although not all, some of them are fixing the game, and no one's happy about that, and no wonder, you know. And I guess that was evidenced to some degree by the 2008 collapse, because it seemed, and I'm just as uninformed as the next person, so I'm capable of commenting on this. It seems from the outside that the rich disproportionately benefited from the restabilization of the economic system. And people are not happy about that. And they shouldn't be happy about that, because it indicates that there's something fundamentally rotten about the game. So you could say, well, maybe people can tolerate necessary inequality if the game isn't rigged. And so that's why everybody has to act in a manner that indicates that the game isn't rigged. And that means they can't rig it. That's really what it means. So, and so we're also being driven into this inequality corner by, I would say, by the postmodernists and the neo-Marxists, because they say, this is the pernicious thing. They say, well, the reason that some people have more than others is because every hierarchy is based on arbitrary power, and they're all oppressors. And the reason they have the money is because they stole it from you. And there's some truth in that, because there are some criminals. But when you get to the point where you fail to distinguish the productive people from the criminals, which is exactly what happened in the 1920s in the Soviet Union, you better bloody well watch out, because when you radically make things egalitarian, you're going to wipe out all your productive people, and then you're going to starve. And so that's one of the doom end scenarios that awaits us if this idiot process of polarization continues. And what I find reprehensible about the universities, and you're tangled up right up to your neck in this, is that the universities are actively agitating to produce people who believe that all inequality is due to oppression and power. And that's just, well, first of all, it's technically wrong. But, no,
but
it's
why
dangerous.
Is that, though? You guys both operate in that system. So what?
Well, here's the problem. As far as I know, nobody has properly studied the question of what fraction of the economy is actually crooked, rent-seeking, right? Not productive. And I fear that the answer to that question is that it's an awful large fraction of the economy, not because of some conspiracy, but because opportunity is finite, but con games aren't. And so anybody who can find a mechanism for transferring wealth from somebody else for doing nothing finds that mechanism. And that thing is ever present. Whereas discovering the next big thing that's actually productive is, you know, something that goes along and fits and starts. And so if we were, I mean, really, you've described it very well. We've got a battle between two caricatures of what's true. Right? Either the market is wonderful and it's producing great stuff with very little corruption, or everything that makes people unequal is the result of corruption. Both of these things are wrong, right? Markets are marvelous engines for figuring out how to do something really well. They're brilliant at this, right? And so people who see that fall in love with it, understandably, because they're so good at it. But what they're terrible at is telling you what you should want or what you should do, right? If people tell markets, here's what we would like to accomplish, and then the markets tell us, well, how do we accomplish that best? That would be a very viable system that would not result in massive rent-seeking, resulting in everybody feeling that all of their misfortunes are the result of a rigged game, which is so massively rigged that when they check, they see, yes, that is actually to a large extent what we're suffering from. But they want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so they want to throw out markets entirely, which, you know, it would be a terrible mistake.
You asked, Joe, why this has happened in the universities. And like that, I think it's one of these runaway positive feedback processes. You know, the universities start to tilt hard to the left in the 60s, and that just went out of control. And now we're at the point where that's the dominant force. And why is probably another manifestation of one of these Pareto principles. It was like, well, at some point there's enough lefties hired so that the probability that they're only going to hire people equally as left or greater starts to reach 100%. And then you iterate that across a couple of generations and you get no conservatives, which is more or less the situation, say, in the humanities and most of the social sciences. And it sort of looks like a conspiracy, but it doesn't mean that anyone is actually planning it, although there are conscious attempts also to silence conservative voices, let's say. And then that's also driven by this postmodern ethos, neo-Marxist ethos, I would say, that says that all of the right, the moral right, is on the side of the left, you know, and so it's the combination of those two things. There's more things. I think I often think comically that if you paid sociology professors three times as much, the probability that they would be anti-capitalist would decline precipitously. Like, I think a lot of it's driven because there's a lot of smart people in academia and they're underpaid relative to their intelligence. So, and that doesn't make them happy. So they get bitter and resentful about that. And they think, well, there's these goddamn bankers who are hauling in $20 million a year. And here I am, hardly struggling, but here I am struggling comparatively. And that's the issue, is comparatively on $100,000 a year, $120,000 a year. You know, I look at that and I think, well, whatever. It doesn't matter. But there's a, like, my colleagues are often angry with me because I do work with the business school. You know, and I also have a business. I'm not anti-capitalist in the least. But it's just dumbfounding to me because they'll come up to me and say, well, are you so sure that you should be working with a business school? And I think, what bloody planet are you from to posit a question like that? All businessmen are evil. It's like, really? That's the level of your sophistication?
This is really an argument that's been presented to you, that businessmen are evil?
Well, they don't come out and say that, but they certainly question my motivations, for example, in forming ties with the business school.
Like, what do they say about it?
They say exactly that. They question my ethics about forming ties with the business school. So,
but they don't give you any reasons for...
You're supposed to... The reason's supposed to be self-evident, Joe.
Oh, okay.
You know,
well,
it's...
So let's give this argument its due. I mean, I don't buy this argument, but nonetheless, let's not caricature it.
Yes, that's good.
In an absolutely free market, which is not what we have, but we have something that tends in that direction. In an absolutely free market, if you compete two individuals, one of whom is completely amoral, will embrace any opportunity if it makes a profit, no matter what it is, and the other individual has some limit to what they will do, well, then there's no question who wins. If we give this experiment a long enough period, the individual who will do anything will outcompete the individual with moral limits because...
Doesn't it depend on what the game is, though? Because
no.
If people find out that you have no moral limits, then they're going to remove themselves from your market.
Unfortunately not. And
no?
Here's the... I know it seems like that, and in any given round, that's true.
Okay.
But to the extent that what you're saying is, to the extent that people police their purchasing and they will stop using Uber if Uber is ethically compromised, for
right.
example. Well, then the point is, well, what's the game? The game is to figure out which things are being monitored and not do any of the unethical things that are being monitored, but to do all of the unethical things that aren't being monitored. And so the individual who is perceiving which things they can get away with has an advantage.
That's the psychopath advantage, right?
Well, I don't even want to call it the psychopath advantage. Right? What this is that a market will train you to do this if it is unregulated. And the best that the ethically restrained person can do is compete dead even. They have no way of getting ahead because the person that is completely free, the amoral business actor, has the ability to do anything that the constrained actor has.
But doesn't this depend entirely upon what the battlefield is?
Not really. There's sort of one exception, and that exception is people who have done something that has suddenly put them in a powerful position, right? So,
Like tech people.
Right. Tech people who have skyrocketed as a result of having innovated the next big thing
right.
have not been through the markets training them to discover the landscape of what isn't being monitored that you can make a profit at.
That's one of the fascinating things about tech people in general is that these gigantic tech corporations almost all lean left.
Well, the gigantic tech corporations lean left. That's true. On the other hand, I mean, I hate to say it, but think about how Google started, right? Don't be evil.
Right.
I think they actually meant that.
Right.
Right? And the thing is, don't be evil is what it sounds like when you haven't been trained by the market to have to do whatever you have to do to beat your competition. You've just come up with the great search engine and suddenly you're on top of the world. But over time, what happens? That entity is now exposed to competition from a bunch of other entities that increasingly will find an advantage in being freer to do ethically questionable stuff. And so what it does is it forces an entity like Google to evolve in the direction of amorality. So now don't
kind
be
evil. Kind
of happened
with China and Google. You know,
yeah.
Because Google wanted to expand into China. And so, you know, they had to make a deal with the devil, so to speak.
Right. And
they had to accept censorship.
They will find ways to rationalize everything, because to not rationalize that which their competitors can avail themselves of would be to perish.
And one of the issues was there was all sorts of fake Google going on, just like they have fake Apple stores in China. They don't have the same sort of copyright laws that we have, and you can essentially plagiarize anything you want.
And Brett, you also said that I shouldn't make a straw man of the anti-business argument of my peers, and there's another way that I shouldn't make a straw man of it. Like, despite the fact that I'm not anti-capitalist, I don't believe that every entity is a business either. And one of the things that has happened to universities that has actually, they've pathologized in a number of dimensions, but they've also pathologized along the business dimension as the administrators have become increasingly trained or drawn from the ranks of business managers. Because a university is actually not a business. It's like a church isn't a business. There are organizations that aren't businesses that you can't just cram into the free market structure willy-nilly. And so my colleagues also object to the transformation of the university into a business entity run by profit-seeking MBAs. And they should object to that, because that's not what the institution is for. So there are reasons for them to be skeptical, say, of my association with the business school that aren't merely a reflection of a simplistic anti-capitalist ideology.
Oh, there are lots of things that have no immunity to contact with the market. Right. What has happened to the university system is that markets have pushed it in all kinds of directions that are not healthy for the mission of the academy. And this is also true, you know, journalism isn't well done in a market either, right? Journalism done in a market ends up telling you what you want to hear, not what you need to know.
Right.
So anyway, markets are wonderful, but there's certain things they shouldn't be allowed to touch, and there are certain things that they shouldn't do, like tell us what to want. Right. There's no magic principle by which a market knows what's healthy and what, you know, you might crave.
Yeah, and
but
so
shouldn't
that,
have.
Well, that also then brings us back to another part of the conservative liberal left dilemma, which is, well, you know, to direct the market means to impose the heavy hand of the state and its potential pathologies on the market. But to leave it alone completely means that it wanders randomly through an indeterminate landscape. And I guess part of the issue there, too, is it's sort of like, well, how do we properly balance foresight and planning, which you'd think would have some role in the construction of large scale states? It's like, well, what do we want the landscape to look like? How do we balance that with the sort of comprehensive computations that the market allows? And of course, the answer to that is we have political discussions about it all the time that are untrammeled, so that we can adjust the ratio between those two things as necessary. So again, that's a argument on the side of free speech. Right?
Yeah, I mean, really, it couldn't be more important. The real answer is that both failures are frightening.
Right.
Right. Mm. You really don't want a state nannying you and overregulating the market and taking the magic out of it. And you don't want the completely unregulated landscape where the market, you know, starts probing the minds of your children and figuring out how to sell them things that they don't have any ability to resist. Right. You need to figure out what that path is. And it's not easy, but you can't do it in a landscape where you can't talk about the